Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this special report. I'm making this one a special report because this is such a trendy subject. I don't think I want to really consume an episode number with it. But I've had a number of listeners come up and say, "Man, have you seen the No Forest on Flat Earth video? Mind-blowing." And I can't disagree. But boy, does it just... Wow. It's just such a great opportunity to talk about this video because it exposes so many methodologies that are good for us and methodologies that I think are a little slippery, slopey. You know, just right off the bat, the gentleman from Russia, or who speaks Russian or something, his name is unpronounceable because he uses, you know, all these special characters in his alphabet. Very soft-spoken guy. If you guys haven't seen this video, I will get into it with you in great detail. But I think that he has accidentally used English in a very bad way, because nowhere in his theory is he suggesting there are no forests on flat Earth. Really. He simply is rebranding what he believes trees to be. He also puts a link down inside the description to a zip file or a Google Drive file that gives you all the assets that he used in his video so that you can propagate this theory. I'm going to see if I can't find him, or if it's still up there. But it's interesting that it looks to me like if there ever was a psyop, ever. This is like hook, line, and sinker sort of thing. And I don't mean to take away the fact that he may truly believe this, but think about it. This incredible 80-minute video, which is for an American who speaks English, I thought that if I listened to it for 30 minutes and his accent would sort of become very fluent to understand, and it hasn't. So it never really gets any easier to understand. As well, I believe that the end of his video never really wraps up that well. There's never really any profound button on the end, which is sort of how I think that folks have presented the video, is to say, wow, there's some revelation at the end, and I didn't get that. If I was supposed to, I completely missed it. So what's the theory about? The theory is that trees are a lot more intense with their lifestyles and their life cycles than we have ever given them credit for, and that's, I believe I have this correct. And again, it's difficult. There's videos of people saying they've seen the video 8 times simply because it's really hard to understand this guy. But his theory is that trees, if we don't chop them down, can become so massive that they're as big as, that the trunks are as big as mountains. And that potentially they reached vastly up into the sky, and that they then turn into a silicon-based sort of a fossilized version of themselves and then die naturally. And then he goes off and sort of does a tangent on his own theory where he talks about the fact that he believes that we are a very old civilization and that we have strip mined the earth for tens of thousands of years, maybe even longer. And he's got some interesting photographs that give you that feeling. It's pretty interesting. I salute him for one major thing, and that is, again, he is taking observable reality and applying some theories to it. I think he's one geology degree behind having really conclusive stuff. And I am no geologist, so I'm going to give you my sort of shady tree geologist connections on what I believe he is seeing. Now, one thing he does brilliantly is he builds it up at the very beginning. A lot of text blocks that, you know, you're eager to find out how anyone could tell you that there are no forests. But again, he doesn't tell you that at all. What he's essentially saying is that, I don't even know what the fuck he's saying with the forest thing. I don't really know what he was meaning, what he was trying to go for when he said it wasn't a forest. But the one big shocker in the video, once he starts explaining himself, because he starts to tell you, and this is sort of a psyop-y thing, he starts to tell you at the very beginning, what I'm about to tell you, you're not going to believe. And that goes on for 5 minutes. And what that ends up doing psychologically is it challenges you to say, no, I'll believe what you say. And so by the time he starts dropping this shit on you, you are hungry to prove that you are going to believe what he has to say. And that's what we got to be careful with these things. But he shows a picture of Devil's Tower. And those for you, for those of you too young to remember Close Encounters of the Third Kind, it was one of the central locations where the aliens came and visited mankind. Devil's Tower is an extremely unique, distinct geological formation that I do not believe is echoed anywhere on planet Earth. It is a gigantic, what looks like, and this is what he's done, which I think is quite brilliant, and I've always had a problem with what this structure, because it's just so unique, so weird. He has said, you're looking at a tree trunk. This big giant mountain was formerly a tree. What you're seeing on the inside is the inside of the tree, which is got this bizarre hexagonal formation, which I'm going to explain. And that the bark on the outside is actually all the little rubber rocks around the bottom of Devil's Tower. And when you see it and you realize that at the bottom, well, the stuff that created it actually has sort of the knotty-looking root base of a tree, your brain starts blowing. You're like, oh my God, I never realized that this thing really looks like a tree. Now, what you're probably seeing is something completely different, but it's going to take me a second to get you there. Then he looks at mesas all over the world, plateaus. And that's when you see, you know, a mountain range go up on both sides in sort of a swooping curve, and then it's just literally chopped off the top. And as a kid, you have a problem trying to figure out, how the hell did that get smooth up there? And then there's this smoother area down here. I'm going to explain everything. But then he links it to Flat Earth. In the title of it, he links it to Flat Earth, but then he makes virtually no reference in 80 minutes to the Flat Earth theory. So it's as if he's trying to usurp the traffic of Flat Earth, which a lot of people are doing. It's unbelievable how many people are making channels, and they'll say, you know, drinking water on Flat Earth, and then it's just like them just drinking water in the video. But because they put Flat Earth on it, they're getting, you know, 500 views and 200 subs. So I'm gonna suggest that if people are using Flat Earth as a title in videos to wean you into their viewing, unsub them, get rid of them, because they're the sort of shilly people that are trying to get, you know, accolades for and traffic and rewards for simply tricking you. And who the hell needs those kind of people in your life, right? And if you're a person who's done it, go erase that out of your title. Unless you're covering a Flat Earth scientific theory development or some more thoughts on it, you shouldn't be saying, you know, naked girls, and then it's just a bunch of, you know, babies in a maternity ward. You know, on this show, I try to evenly represent globe Earth and Flat Earth, because I believe that right now, honestly, if I were to sit a bunch of people in front of me, there's a lot more pieces of evidence for Flat Earth than there is globe Earth. And I can't even believe I'm able to say that with a straight face, but that's true. However, as I have mentioned many times, the one thing that makes me believe that this is a globe Earth, and if this isn't true, then a Flat Earthers have something to explain. I would love to see or hear Eric Dubé talk about what I'm about to discuss, because I believe that what I'm about to discuss is utterly conclusive in some geological way. And that is the theory of expanding Earth. If you were not familiar with expanding Earth, it was a theory that was taught in colleges up to the early 60s. There's a gentleman who's a cartoonist. His name is Neil Adams. About 5 years ago, Neil debuted a video that he had created. It may even be 10 years by now. I didn't find it until about 5 years ago. Let's just put it that way. But he runs an animation where he shows you that the theory of Pangaea drift, where all the continents fit together. You know, you can look at South America and look at Africa, and you can realize that South America was butted up into the side of Africa. It's just a no-brainer, right? Well, so does the entire continents of North America, South America, Europe, and Africa. It just butts up. But what Neil reveals is very carefully in front of your face, without reshaping the continents, the entire world, by subtracting the oceans, comes together in a ball that's approximately about a fourth of the size of Earth. So instead of Pangaea drift pushing all the continents together on one side, you can wrap the whole thing around, like when you make a ball with your two hands, right? there's the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean that created this ability for us to expand. And I'll get into how you expand in a minute here. But the Pacific Ocean has a seam down the center. If you look at Google Earth, you can see it, and you can see a seam down the center of the Atlantic Ocean. The Atlantic Ocean, for whatever reason, has a thicker crust and expanded slower. What do I mean by expanded? Well, in the seam is essentially where a bunch of lava plates sort of pop out of the mantle and scoot, and then they actually shatter due to cooling, and there's a guy that's been tracking these plates for over 30 years, and he's given them all names, and he's seen plates come out in his lifetime. It's really amazing. But the Pacific has a much weaker crust, and so it expanded way faster, which is why the Pacific got way larger than the Atlantic and consequently a lot lower sea level wise than the Atlantic, which you've heard me talk about this a couple times if you've seen all the shows. Now here's the thing. At some point, the Atlantic spilled into the Pacific and we got a major, major flood situation, probably way before man ever existed. But around the Indonesian islands, if you look at the bottom of Google Earth, you'll see the splash mark on the bottom of the ocean. And you're talking about an ocean from the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean that's a mile higher than the Pacific. When that crashed down, you have this gigantic tidal wave coming at what's now California. Probably a lot of the light mountain ranges that we have here off the coast of California could have been created by the splash of this giant, who knows how tall it would be by the time it would hit us. Probably about a half a mile high, which would be 2,500 feet, people. But the reason why when I grew up in Kansas, we had seashells, a lot of sea life, little tiny fossils, is probably because of this wave coming in and splashing literally the Central America, the Salt Lake City, salt flats could be easily created by this big splash, and then it runs off and dries up all the salt from the ocean, from all the sea life. And so I believe that most definitely this expanding thing is true. If it's not true, it would be, and we're on a flat disk and there's no expansion whatsoever, then I would say someone either use this technique to spin the pizza dough, or it's part of the illusion that would be just as elaborate as saying, why are all the planets in the solar system round, the sun's round, the moon's round, and somehow we're flat? And if someone says, well, that's to create the illusion that you're in this round ball, blah, 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 well, then expanding Earth is right up there with the illusion. But for me, expanding Earth currently is the number one reason why I believe that, however it's possible, the world is probably round. Oh, it's tough. But now, the one thing that I didn't see Neil or anyone else do, and I have done tons of like models of this, is that once you see expanding Earth and it makes sense to you, which takes about 2 seconds, I've shown it to the most non-conspiratorial people on planet Earth, brilliant people, and they look at it and they go, well, that's pretty tough to deny. I'm like, yeah, it is, isn't it, right? But what would it mean if you were to have no oceans and just kind of swampy areas? And I should mention there was a German contingency of scientists that reverse engineered the age of the oceans by looking at the salt content increase year over year and then reverse engineering the algorithm to find out when the ocean would have no salt. And they basically estimated that the oceans are about 60 million years old, which is very young for what we believe to be the age of the Earth. Forget dinosaurs and all that kind of stuff. If you have a planet that is 1/4 the size that it is today, then you need to account for what geographically would happen on the surface during expansion. What will happen is that very strong geological formations will remain, and very weak formations will shatter and sink and turn into dust. Now, I should describe just for 1 second how expanding Earth, I believe, occurs, because no one's really had the balls to say how it occurs. My belief system stems off of a lot of stuff that Eric Dollar was told as a kid by the Navy and RCA, which is that they believe that the sun and the earth and all celestial bodies have a plasma energy core. It's pure electricity, which is why you have poles north and south. It makes complete sense. Forget all this nickel bullshit. The reason why everything rings like a bell when hit is that it's hollow. Not hollow earth where people live on the other side of the, you know, talking about electrical interior. The electricity stimulates and attracts dust on the outside, which then turns into a crust, which then turns into a surface that we can walk on. Because space is very cold, and the center of the Earth is extremely, or not the center, but the outer surface of this plasma ball is very hot. You get the magma core, and then you have plates that we can stand on, and then, of course, atmosphere. We're lucky with an M1 class planet. We can survive. Okay. The reason why we expand is that it only takes... Well, I'll put it this way. The reason why we expand is that the circumference of a planet is determined by the overall plasma core size. Plasma energy is sort of the stem cell of all mass in the universe, right? The sun being the biggest plasma ball out there. You know, when you see sunspots, it's my belief still that you're looking into the bowels of the sun. It exudes, this is all based on heliocentric solar system, so if Forest Line Project comes around and says the world's flat, then you can toss most of this out. But if the sun is what we think it is, it has a gigantic core of electricity, which is why the center of the sun is much colder than the surface. The surface is at millions and millions of degrees, and the interior is only at a few thousand degrees that we've been able to measure. And we look at sunspots to figure this out. So when you have a sunspot, we can do a... redshift on that, a temperature shift, and just figure out that it's much cooler. But the sun is exuding all of this primal energy, which does not gather up easily. It only attracts to other primal energy. And so you have the sun exuding plasma energy in a non-combusted form. It's invisible. It comes into the perhaps the north pole of our planetoid structure. It goes down into the bowels of Earth and charges it up. The more it gains energy, the more it gains pressure, the more it gains its form, and thus expands the crust 19 centimeters a year. And that's what Geneva has tracked the Earth's expansion at. Geneva's also attempted to crush that mathematic because it really gives way to the full ecosystem of how our planet works, which if you do all of the rabbit hole research, you'll find out that it leads directly to methane gas being created in the crust of the Earth, which, when crushed by carbon, turns into crude oil, thus declassifying crude oil from a fossil fuel into a natural byproduct of the Earth, which is why when we drill big mother loads of crude oil out of the Earth, and then we cap the wells because we're done, there is no more down there, they fill back up again, which is why we'll never run out of the stuff. Doesn't mean we should be using oil, I'm just saying the stuff is an infinite supply. So, expanding Earth. If you had a planet that was 1/4 the size with sort of a nice layer cake crust on top, and then you had this magma stuff that is being exacerbated by a plasma core of a planet, and you could take traditional models of the nickel core and you'll still get the same thing. You were going to get at some points the surface magma to want to escape this constant push out from the center of this plasma core, meaning a volcanic type eruption. So let's say you have sedimentary rock on the outside of the Earth at this really small diameter, right? Well, just like the moon Io, which has tremendously, you know, crazy volcanic eruptions on its surface, we know we have volcanoes everywhere, right? And this guy tries to explain away volcanoes, and I'll get to that. But you're going to have a rupture area on the surface of the planet Earth where this specific type of magma can come out. And you could have it build up like a pimple, which is what you call a volcano. Or you could merely have a pool on the surface of Earth where if you were a giant walking on Earth back when the Earth is 1/4 the size, you would look down at a little puddle that would be a big pool of this hot magma, right? Magma. And this stuff will probably dry at some point and dry at a particular rate. And then it'll be just this gigantic, beautiful rock formation in the ground that surface matches the surface that you're walking on. But the stuff that's kind of holding it in place, right? Just like a kiln. The side stuff that's holding this sort of metal rock into place, it's more malleable over time then the stuff that's drying in the center, which is starts off as a hot liquid, and then it dries to a really hard rock formation. Then you expand the Earth. Well, what happens when we see expansion in earthquakes? We see cracks, right? And if you want to see further evidence of expanding Earth, go look at the Black Sea, go look at any long lake, and you can combine, you can get rid of the lake and push the two sides together, and the jagged edges match on both sides, telling you right in front of your face that this used to be together, and it's been ripped apart due to expansion from below. Pressure from below, it's pushing these two plates apart. So when you have the Earth cracking apart due to an earthquake expanding the Earth, you know that you've got a chasm now. And whatever was together is going to start eventually when it starts raining. If you start walking on the edge of that chasm is going to start falling down into the crevice, right? And eventually, it's going to turn into something that looks like the Grand Canyon, where a sedimentary rock just keeps falling in. Now, if the two sides that are being pulled apart are very weak and loose soil, well, you know that the shape of the sedimentary runoff is going to be pretty profound and smooth because this stuff's weak. It's just going to fall in there like loose dirt. But if you were to pull apart due to extreme pressure, two granite, you know, one big granite rock, and you split it in half and you pull it apart, what's going to happen is it's not going to change much. You will have just exerted the force to crack an anvil in half. And you know, if you were to be able to chop an anvil in half with the Dragon Slayer sword, right? And you got one half and the other half. You know that you could sit there for 10,000 years and the thing will probably be the exact same shape when you come back. Same thing goes with sedimentary rock during expansion. Okay? So, when we have something like Devil's Tower, here's what I think you're looking at. The top of Devil's Tower, which, by the way, if you take all this elevational plateaus and you go from sea level and measure up to these plateaus, they're pretty unified across the entire world. They're all the same height, roughly, depending on what sedimentary rock we're dealing with here. So if one erodes a little bit faster per capita, it is a little bit lower. But most of these things, if you go to Arizona and the United States of America and you're on the Interstate 10, you're looking at those old cowboy deserts, right? You're going to be looking at a lot of plateaus that have the exact same elevation from sea level. So imagine that Devil's Tower, we rise up using some soil we get down at the local botany joint. We put soil all around Devil's Tower until we stack it up just to the height of Devil Tower's top. And then we stand there and we look at Devil's Tower, standing on top of the sedimentary rock that is surrounding that structure. Well, what's it look like? It looks like a pool of hardened rock. Okay, so let's now play it forward. The Earth expands. The sedimentary rock that gave it its form now just deteriorates and kind of mixes with the ocean or blows in the wind or whatever. And the one thing that's super duper strong, this tempered rock, stays there because it dried and was created of something way more intense than dirt. So I know a lot of you are thinking who watched the video, you're saying, but wait, dude, the guy made a really strong point about this hexagonal format all over Earth. And there's something unbelievably gorgeous about the hexagonal thing. For those of you who've studied sacred geometry, and I can't believe this guy didn't tap into this theory at all. He just kept getting mystified by it. Bless his heart. This plasma ball that we're on, if that's true, exudes, well, I'll put it this way, whatever we're on, it exudes the natural frequency of a hexagon. And what's really profound about that shape, and you know, for those of you who haven't seen it, you know, you can take a speaker and you can put sand on it, really fine sand, and when you play a certain tone, certain frequency, the sand divides up and creates patterns. So if you can just look up whatever the tone is for a hexagonal pattern, or it creates a honeycomb right in front of your face, all interlocked and connected, that's the natural frequency coming out of the bowels of the Earth. For any of you who've studied tempered glass, okay, so there used to be sheet glass, and then there's tempered glass. Well, when I grew up, half the world was, probably two-thirds of the world was sheet glass. And what's that mean? Well, when you accidentally ran through your sliding screen door or, your front door on your house and the glass broke, you could die instantaneously, because this stuff's going to break into large shards like swords, and it will cut you and kill you, knock your arteries open, and you know, you're rushing to the hospital to survive the next 10 minutes of your life. Then eventually, we split it up where we placed most of incidental glass in a house with plastic, so it couldn't break at all. And everything else, like your car windows, were made with something called tempered glass. There's tempered steel, right? As I understand it and remember it from school, was that you dry the glass at different rates, or sorry, you cool it off at different rates on one side versus the other side to create a crystalline structure of what's actually in the glass. So it aligns the particles, essentially, such that when it breaks, it clumps up in these nice non-shardy things. It's absolutely ingenious. When you used to make screwdrivers that are non-tempered steel, if you try to pry something open with a screwdriver, these would just break, just like a breadstick. And once they started tempering steel along the vector of a lever, then you could just bend the crap out of it, right? And the steel would bend if you were to exert too much pressure. Well, imagine, again, you've got some lava. It's made of a really, really specific combination of granite or whatever. It's just like mixing the most incredible cement recipe, because cement is, you know, been made differently. And supposedly the cement that the Romans have is far more resilient than what we have ever created today, which is interesting. And I come from a cement factory community. Some people were raised in like coal mine areas. My little hometown and the next two towns up were all about cement. So somehow, some really good stuff was mixed down there, which turned into Devil's Tower. So here it comes hitting the soil that's above, and it's bouncing into the organic formations and it's trying to exert force naturally up, right? And then it finally finds a weak spot in the surface and starts to jet straight up. Well, at this point, it's just a pool of whatever rock the Devil's Tower is made out of. But then it cools. It cools from exposing the very top layer, and it cools based on the sedimentary rock that's around it. And this honeycomb pattern, which is obviously some format that exudes from the center of this planet, also assists in the alignment of the particles as they attempt to settle down. It would seem that the way you need to view this is, if you were to take a cookie cutter in dough, you know that you've spread out the dough even, and if you took a cookie cutter of a honeycomb, a hexagon, and you push it down, you know that you have disturbed the particles where the cookie cutter is going to actually hit the dough, right? On a geological natural formation frequency energy model, the frequency coming out of the center of the Earth would behave a bit like a razor blade coming up from the center of the Earth, always exacerbating the particles in the pattern of the hexagon, such that they don't settle down well, such that these rocks actually start to cut into the hexagonal format. Now, it could be because they do curve, right? It could be that this entire thing was actually more vertical at one point, and because of stresses and the way things moved underneath, because of the surfaces underneath are kind of like rivers, they could have expanded this thing out. It could be that more force came in from underneath. Not quite sure why these honeycomb things actually do make a curve towards the center, but that could be an incidental thing, such that if you ever run metal through a press, they make these I-beams, right? We're running reinforced steel formulas through, and then at that point you can bend it into whatever shape you want. Could be that that's a natural way it happens as well. Could be that the frequency goes into the metal, which can carry the frequency, and regardless of what shape it's in, its vector of movement is where the cookie cutter just simply runs up the side of these rails of hexagonal rock. It dries. Sedimentary arc falls apart off of this structure due to the expansion of the Earth. The outer crust, you know, gets exposed to the elements, gets exposed to all kinds of things, breaks off and creates these little clumpy piles. What we don't have in the clumpy piles is any evidence of bark, which is what he's trying to say. But it is very alluring to see this. So the other thing that he's done is he went around the world and picked out pictures, for one, a bunch of the hexagonal rocks, which is amazing. But then he shows you sort of how a bee and a wasp and various other insects seem to create these hexagonal patterns in their nests. He also looked at the hexagonal patterns that control the way that salt dries in a salt flat. And the salt was actually the way that I believe that you can see the frequency exuding from the center of the earth, whereby the actual edges of the salt hexagonal patterns, which aren't perfect, because salt is very, you know, it's very malleable and it's moving at the same time, it's absorbing the frequency. So distorting it from perfect hexagonal patterns is sort of, you know, just a given. But it's the edges of where the hexagonal pattern happens, where the salt was actually higher than the center. And that shows you sort of a vector of force going straight up. Now, as far as a wasp and a bee and all the different insects that use hexagonal patterns to build their nests, it could be a little more subtle. It could be, and the big question is why are there hexagonal patterns that make up Devil's Tower, where the hexagon patterns are seemingly 10 to 12 feet in diameter, and then you go down to a little nest and they're, you know, maybe a third of a centimeter in size. There's also organic, you know, formations and eye sockets and insects and things that seem to exude this as well. But now an insect is intentionally stacking up their resin to create these nests. I've got wasps, actually yellow jackets in my backyard that make nests all up in my awnings of my rooftop here. And they etch wood out of the furniture I've got outside. They etch it out of the awning that's in the intro, and you can hear them just scraping it off. It's really wild. I've been out here, and it's like, and it's just an insect grabbing wood pulp and taking it up and making a nest out of it. They obviously have a very symbiotic relationship with this frequency, such that either their brains somehow see it, or they have it programmed into their DNA. But now let me give you this. What if the eye socket of an insect has a natural sort of pixelated formation? When they look out their eyeballs and they look down at a smooth surface, they see the hexagonal pattern, because that's the way the lenses in their multiple lens eyes actually work. And so essentially what they're looking at is an overlay of pattern. And so they simply just drop this resin in the pattern that they automatically see. Could be one way it works, right? But there's something beautiful. We have the Fibonacci pattern, which is known as the golden mean, and we have this hexagonal reality to the universe. And because it seems to be an organic common denominator of how insects build their nests and how Devil's Tower was created and a lot of other rocks around the world, it's got to be something that's coming out of the earth and dictating its mathematical guidelines to mass and the consciousness of insects. Now, human beings, we don't see any of that stuff, right? We don't think in hexagons, unless you're a Dungeons and Dragons player or something. But his next assertion, which was very, very interesting, is that... And I don't mean chronologically next, but one of them is that the strip mining analogy that he puts together in this thing. And again, I have to salute this guy, because he's helping us to massage in our brain observable reality and trying to connect it to other observable reality. So if he's a completely organic guy and he's not trying to pull some psyop on anyone, which is no indication that he did, then he's got a good mind. And he'll probably find, if this isn't true, he'll probably find something else that is, that'll be very valuable to all of us, right? But he shows you strip mining. And if those of you don't know, there are various mining techniques. You know, when you mine for coal, it's different than mining for gold and platinum and that kind of thing. You know, some of these, you can have a copper mine where you're digging into to a mother load of something, or definitely gold mining when you go dig down inside of the bowels of a mountain, and you're just digging it out of the walls. And then you have strip mining, where you'll sit there and you have a big, gigantic, heavy equipment vehicle with a big, you know, almost, tiger claw rotating disc that is just being dragged across the edge of a mountain, and it's just strip mining in a big circle. And his most convincing photographs of what I'm about to say are from the Antarctica, which is very interesting. But what he realized was that there was a there's a distinct pattern that is the byproduct of strip mining, whereby there's a stair-stepping slope that must be created when the strip mining occurs. Because, you know, if you everybody knows if you were to, you know, dig a cave, you've had a mountain that was straight up and down, and you start digging a cave in, and you start digging up and up and up diagonally, eventually the mountain's going to lose its integrity and fall on you and kill you. So in order to keep that from occurring, we reverse the angle to a slope by which we take more off the top edge, the median in the middle, then we go down as far as we can. We resituate the vehicle and go back up and do it again and again until we just keep taking it off, right? And then, of course, it's all dumped into those gigantic dump trucks that are size of houses, which I grew up with where I come from because of cement. A lot of times you'll be digging for one thing and you'll always find coal. It's very interesting. Okay, so what he did was take his observable eye and he connected it to a lot of natural rock formations where it seems as if this stair-stepping effect has occurred all around the world. And his assertion was to say, again, he kind of blames, it seems he vacillates between blaming a boogeyman that, you know, is raping the planet Earth and just sort of saying that we had a previous civilization that might have done this, right? The one thing I want you to remember is that when someone claims that we had, you know, amazing technology from a long, long time ago, and somehow we lost every bit of it, you know, I find that hard to believe simply because we're looking at right now the ruling class of this world actually getting, you know, robotic technology to a point that they could, if they could just manufacture them quick enough and deploy them quick enough, they could take over the entire planet with your sort of, you know, your THX-1138 cops. And you could shoot them with shotguns and nothing's going to happen, you know. So I feel like to claim that we have been here a long, long time ago and somehow through all that brilliance we accidentally reset society and they lost control and maybe. But this erosion that he is looking at, you know, there's a slight chance he's correct and that somehow we had these big, giant machines that then, you know, a long time ago, a society that isn't us really strip mined the crap out of Antarctica and then got rid of the machine, picked it up and took it away. And that's the thing I think is a little hard to believe is usually when you find, you know, a mining operation that's been abandoned, sure, they'll take the machines if they can use them someplace else. But if there's, you know, if the dump truck has been used so much it has no use, you know, they'll just leave it there. They don't necessarily clean up after each other. So there's no evidence of there being anything that actually did the work. And something that massive would probably leave some sort of mark and some sort of intelligent signature behind. But now when you study ancient Egypt, there's something very specific that's going on there. You have, just to catch you guys up, so a lot of the Egyptologists that went down, the archaeologists that went down there, they merely were archaeologists. They weren't geologists. They weren't physicists. They weren't specialists in, you know, electricity. And so all of what they had deduced about the pyramids being tombs was just hogwash. You know, you didn't have an expert mind making those deductions. You merely had a person who knows how to dig crap out of the ground, who has essentially book learning when it comes to what history says was true. And if you think about the average IQ of someone in history in, say, 1940, where revisionistic history was well underway, and they're digging up things that they don't know anything about to begin with, we barely had hieroglyphs translated before these guys were finding, you know, the tombs in the Valley of the Kings and that sort of thing. You have a situation where we misinterpreted most of it. And so in the last 10 years, we've had specialists that go in and relook at what the tombs are and say, this is, you know, or sorry, the Valley of the King tombs, and then look at the pyramids and say, you really think these are tombs? Haven't you seen a tomb in the Valley of the Kings? There's very specific requirements to cross the River Styx, and all of that is missing in its entirety out of these pyramids, which are big, giant electrical batteries, right? Go see my episode on ancient Egypt if you want to see all the details of that. Why mention that? Well, the reason why I mentioned that is that they finally brought a geological erosion expert, a PhD out of New York, that came and did the analysis of the rock around the Sphinx to determine whether or not this was a man-made structure, whether it was natural erosion, and to date the erosion. And again, it's big, giant approximations, and they're very honest about it, which is nice, instead of coming in and saying, no, for sure this. Which, if you talk to the curators of the Cairo Museum, they're not uncertain about anything. They know absolutely everything. And it's sort of cartoony and shallow and just lacks any I would say, congruence with what Graham Hancock has revealed in his research by going down there and re-examining everything. So, the reason why I bring that up is that the gentleman that made this no forest on flat earth thing, when he starts bringing up the strip mining theory, again, there's a couple photos, again, that seem to be very convincing that either the natural formation of earth is sometimes just beautifully geometric, or man participated, or some being participated in the strip mining. But again, if you strip mine, it's usually because you're using it for something. And if you're on a flat earth, it doesn't really make any sense that we'd be in this petri dish and somehow we're strip mining and taking it to another petri dish. That just seems a little bit weird. On a globe earth, well, you can get into your Planet X Nibiru, you know, exploitation of earth, and they're stripping things and taking it to their world. But then where are they? You know, because we've been here for quite a while and we haven't seen them. But there's a natural stair-stepping erosion on virtually every single mountain you've ever flown over in a jet. And what's interesting about it is that he was trying to say that these forests are built out of these silicon-based tree forms. And I guess he's trying to say that they start off wood and they eventually get to a silicon level of composition. He never quite covered the transition between the two. You know, of course we've all been to forests, my God, which is why, again, I think his translation is really bizarre. Why would you say no forests? He never negates the fact that there are forests everywhere, ever, right? He just simply says, well, these mountains are trees. It's okay. All you're disputing is that what we think trees are different. And again, as far as I know, we've never dug into a redwood and found silicon cores to them, or silicon signatures, where it's starting to become a petrified tree right before our very eyes. So even though he inundates you with photographs of mountains that have plateaus, look like they could be tree stumps, I think you're looking at a natural formation that went up to the old sedimentary rock, and because this particular mountain is made of something a lot stronger than the sedimentary rock, when the world expanded, the sedimentary rock wiped away, blew away, rained away, and what you have left is essentially the natural formation of magma coming up and then finding a surface and leveling off. But what he didn't do in his video was sort of what you do in scientific method, which you have a control experiment. He didn't show you that the majority of the world, I'm going to guess more than 90% of the entire planet, has mountains everywhere, and they have no physical relation to his hypothesis of mountains being trees. So if his theory is correct, and I'm not saying it's not, there were very few of these massive trees on Earth. Very, very few. Because most of the mountains are just regular old sedimentary rock. They seem to have, you know, depending on where you are, the Himalayas are way higher than, you know, Colorado and that sort of thing. They look like natural erosions. Now, he tried to say that the craters on Earth aren't craters at all, that they are actually sort of, I guess, sinkholes or something based on some natural formation. Yeah, that could be true. There's been a lot of videos that I've seen over the years describing craters as not craters. It could be related to expanding Earth. They are incredibly bold. Now, there's two places that I have been several times in my lifetime. One is the Petrified Forest that he mentions in his video, including the Painted Canyon, which is really close by, and the crater that he filmed in Arizona, whose name escapes me, but I've been there several times. When you go to these, especially the big crater in Arizona, you can go to the gift shop that hangs over one of the edges of the crater, and you can buy these little pouches of iron rocks, and it's the dust from whatever hit the earth and obliterate it into a bunch of, you know, pieces of iron rock. And so it's essentially how they found, you know, what they claim to be moon rocks. And, you know, again, like I've said several times, the embalming equipment used in Egypt was built out of refined iron melted down from meteorites in the desert of Egypt, which would be very south of the lush area that Egypt was living in at the time. Which is why if you look at the embalming tools of the Egyptians and you look at the radioactive signature in them, you are going to find objects that are actually not from this world. Doesn't mean they were aliens. It just means it was the easiest way to find refined iron ore was from a meteorite. So when I'm trying to think, the last time I was at the meteor impact in Arizona, we walked around quite a bit of the outer perimeter and we found these little rocks that they were selling in the gift shop. You're not supposed to take them with you, and I don't think we did. But so they're there, you know. And so unless someone's trying to complete the illusion, running out like bird feeders and dumping these little rocks everywhere, they're everywhere. There are people that go to the desert today with metal detectors, and they comb the deserts for meteorites. And they, you know, most of them are little tiny particles here and there, but they register as iron. If they find a big one, they can usually sell it to a museum. That's how they found supposedly the rock that was the big, you know, there's life on Mars rock, which was such a ridiculous assertion during Clinton's administration, I believe in 1999 or something like that. You know, stuff falls out of the sky. If any of you have seen a meteor shower and you believe in flat Earth, you got a lot of explaining to do. We got to figure out how, when we zoom up on a particular region of the sky, you know, when they do the average count of a cubic foot and then spread that over the circumference of the atmosphere, we are being bombarded by 100 million little particles per minute. You know, probably 99.9% of them burn up, but that little percentage that's left is quite a bit. We've had meteorites come down into people's homes and, you know, jam through a three-story house and through a car and go through the the cement foundation. One guy was hit by one, or one was hit by one in the hip about 15 years ago. So there's all kinds of this stuff really takes place, people. So if it's a big firmament dome, then where are these things coming from and why? And why are they just this sort of fundamental iron ore rock and not something more intelligent? I don't know. Eric Dubé, there's something I want you to explain. Just in case anyone's trying to read anything to my subtext or my tone, I think Eric Dubé is awesome. I think regardless if he's right about everything he talks about, I think he does a beautiful job with what he does. He came out with two rappers did a song based on his flat earth theory, and it was awesome. It was fantastic. But now I'm going to point you to the second episode I came out with, which is on evolution. I think it's where I put this particular theory. But I want to put a little button on the end of this video to make you think a little bit more about the organic life that you observe every single day. Okay. Now, I talked about expanding Earth. I talked about the plasma core, which is an eternal force that pushes out from the center of what we're on, and that this is sort of how we get volcanoes. You know, the guy in the video talked about the fact that volcanoes aren't volcanoes, and, you know, it was like a combustive sedimentary rock that basically, when they were digging, they made, you know, piles of stuff they didn't want, and that somehow catches on fire and does a little pop or something. Sort of hard to follow him entirely on that, but have you ever wondered, I'm going to repeat the theory here, have you ever wondered how anything grows up in the world? How does a blade of grass go straight up? How does a tree go straight up? Especially a redwood tree, you know? How does that happen if gravity is mass pulling against mass? The traditional explanation for what we otherwise refer to as a natural phenomenon, which is gravity. Because there has to be some kernel of life that turns into the protein patterns and the crystalline structures that create all life. There has to be a moment where that actually gains the wisdom and the ability to construct itself in a vertical fashion. So go back to the beginning of Earth, when this green stuff started appearing on the outside of the earth, blue algae or whatever. If you see algae and moss, it behaves just like a planet made of gravity. You know, mass against mass theory. Because what does moss do? It grows over like a a coat over whatever contour that it's growing on. It adheres to the shape of the object, and it seems to comb the surface of the earth. So does algae in the ocean, right? But how does a blade of grass get to a point where a blade of grass can go straight up? Because isn't every single split second of that blade of grass having gravity pull it down towards the center of the earth? So why would a blade of grass ever go up? How could it go up if every single split second of its existence, it's being yanked down? Why wouldn't everything just go down into the bowels of the earth? And then how can you have chlorophyll that uses light to photosynthesize to create oxygen? How would that ever happen? Because it would never reach the surface. So how would any organic life ever exist, ever? My theory is this, and for those of you that have studied this for more than, say, 30 years, every once in a while, when I was a kid, there was a scientific paper that came out that talked about how that there's this invisible force that pushes out from the center of the earth, and it's on such a subatomic level that we don't obviously sense it ourselves. With your instruments, we can sense it. That's where the plasma core comes in. And that's where you can drag in a dielectric wave off of any sort of electrified surface. A dielectric wave uses longitudinal waves of energy, which is an instantaneous transfer of energy. It comes off in a perpendicular line from the inner core of any sphere or wire. And it goes straight out. Through expanding Earth and through Eric Dollard and connecting those two together and saying the RCA in the Navy told him as an 11-year-old kid that the internals of the sun, which they actually called it a portal. I'm not sure they're talking about human beings going through a portal or alien life going through a portal, but energy going through a portal, transferring to somewhere else in the universe or whatever. I don't know why they thought they needed to go that far with it. If we simply have an electric core, and if all the recent cosmologists that are reengineering all their theories based on electricity movement instead of gravitons, then you would have an invisible force that would help plants go to the surface and continue developing crystalline structures in their composition, their DNA that's dictated by their protein patterns, to create a tower that goes up, which on a microscopic level would be a blade of grass, on a macro level could be a redwood tree. But then there was a little bit of research I did in the 90s where I was going for the unified theory. And along the way, again, this is sort of a little bit of a repeat from episode 2, but I doubt many of you are going back to that episode. You need to remember that all life that is observable in this world is born inside of a gravity bubble. A localized region whereby gravity doesn't really have any localized effect on the DNA and protein patterns that are forming. And what do I mean by that? Well, a lot of life form is born inside of an egg. Organic life forms are born inside seeds. A human being is born inside of a womb of water or in a cellular membrane. I believe that these encompassing structures are important and are the actual key to giving a sort of barrier of directional preference. It allows the organism to do what it wants to do. But in terms of a seed, right, because a seed gets fixed into the soil and has an orientation. And then if you've ever looked at the, you know, time-lapse photography where they grow it in sort of an anthill, you know, glass plate, you can see that the seed, regardless, will start creating this crystalline structure, which is known as its stem, and it starts to move around. Someone comes south and they go north, and they immediately make it out to the surface of the soil. And we're taught as children that the plant knows what's up and what's down. And I think there's, without this invisible force, as dictated by some dielectric wave coming off the center of the earth in a plasma core, there's nothing that accounts for the fact that there is somehow wisdom inside of a seed. Now, I've said in previous episodes, I believe that plants have conscious life just like us. It's ridiculous not to think so, in my opinion. But some of these just beeline straight for the surface. And I believe that whatever is life force, whatever is the wisdom of our consciousness, is somehow picking up on this wave coming from the center of the earth. Could just be all mathematical. It's just a force that's so weak we don't track it with our instrumentalities, right? But it nudges all of the formational guidelines to go up. Not really related to no forest, but, well, maybe it is on the fundamental level. I think the no forest thing is, again, an admirable exercise in taking the observable planet and simply correlating shapes together. I do personally believe the Devil's Tower and all these plateaus slash mesas that are all over the world are merely old surface soil that has been undisturbed because it is so strong in its formation that it doesn't get affected. And just to put a button on it too, he made a big point about showing you the hexagonal formation of the interior of Devil's Tower and suggesting that that's the cellular pattern that you find at the center of a tree trunk. Now, I forgot to mention that I actually work with wood and help turn gigantic tree stumps into beautiful vases with my writing mentor. So I've done a lot of, you know, chainsawing and chiseling and spinning stuff on a lathe, and then we put it in a bag for 2 years and then pull it out and re-chisel it back down after it's warped and all the water's pulled out of it, and then it's become something really gorgeous, you know. So I've seen wood at the really intimate levels, and at most what he is trying to equate is a hexagonal crystalline pattern is probably dictated by some frequency coming out of our earth with a cellular structure which is very organic and chaotic and the ring formation of the center of a stump. And if you've ever been really close to wood like I have, you'll know that there's really no correlation between the two. Even if you were to zoom up the cells are stacked up, you know, in a cellular structure. It's a big grid of cells that don't have any unification in the hexagonal method. They just aren't. Now, the interesting thing about it, this particular theory, that unlike Flat Earth, which has a lot of, it poses a tremendous amount of questions, exposes the validity of space programs, and a lot of the science that we simply swallowed because we were young and impressionable, this particular theory is so new, and, you know, it does lack a lot of correlations with, again, most of the mountainous formations on Earth, and including what I was going to say was that the plateaus and the mesas lack any of this hexagonal stuff. It's just Devil's Tower and a bunch of other formations, which are very few in number, that have this particular thing. I believe that the base of Mount Rushmore, the hexagonal rocks happen. And they happen at all kinds of different diameters, too. Some are just 10 inches, some are 10 feet. So it's interesting how whatever happens, it probably is a frequency that expands and contracts based on the connected nature of the actual sedimentary lava that is actually, or not lava, but the big heavy rock that no longer pops out of anything. You know, we don't have pools of magma that are going to turn into big granite mountains. With that, whatever made that happen, that is over. That frequency is over. You know, so we're past that era. But this is a great exercise that people have been looking into, and what's fun about it is that for the very first time I've seen more than half of the community that looks at these theories sort of reject this particular one. And it's good. They all got in. They took a big deep breath. They opened their minds. They viewed all the information. And they came away thinking, yeah, I don't think so. It's a really neat romantic idea, but I don't think so. And I think that has been probably the most healthy thing that's happened with this particular theory. And there are the folks that have dove completely off. But what, again, I don't see from the people that tend to believe this stuff is that they have any of this other stuff, any of these other theories, any of these other kind of sort of scientific nuggets to attach to the theory to discern it one way or the other. And so I'm not saying it's true or false because I simply don't know, but I just gave you my entire hunch on seeing this portrayed in this video. So if you haven't got into Flat Earth, there's a theory for you there. It's got a whole bag of science. It has nothing to do with this guy. If you haven't gotten into Expanding Earth, it is so utterly conclusive from my brain that, again, if you're into Flat Earth and you haven't dealt with Expanding Earth, then you got to jump into Expanding Earth, and you'll start to kind of wonder, well, then, you know, why is this? Maybe it's just the space programs are lying to us. Maybe that's the only thing that's ever happened that gives us the idea of Flat Earth. You know, again, rainbows are 180 degree formations, which doesn't correlate with anything going on in the atmosphere of a flat Earth. I mean, of a round Earth, excuse me. So confusing, is it not? Right? I think that's about all I got to say about it. Thanks for tuning in here. This has just been a little special report. Haven't done one of these in quite a while. I appreciate you guys trudging through it. If you haven't already been, go to mkultraradio.com for all the feeds. It's basically, if you're on video and you want audio, you can flip. If you're on audio and you'd like video, you can flip. You can enjoy both sides as well. There's a Facebook page as well from the website, so you can get in and kind of contribute on that side. Our Facebook for Deep Thoughts is, it's light, you know, but it gives us a chance to communicate on our level. So again, thanks for coming. Please subscribe and like if you dig it. And I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.